sure you get home, boys. They got your back, the pride of the fleets, the bright swinging frogmen of the UTT.
Hey folks, Commander Mark Devine coming at you from SEAL Fit headquarters in sunny Encinitas, California. Listen, today I'm excited to have a conversation with my friend Rob Wolf, who is the author of The Paleo Solution. Now, Rob worked with the guy who kind of came up with the whole paleo concept, or not the concept, but the paleo diet, a guy named Lauren Cordain. And he worked with Lauren and did some deep research, and then he took it out into his own private business and has been, you know, coaching people in nutrition and, of course, functional fitness for many years with pretty astounding results. And now Rob is definitely a nutrition nerd, and he's got more information. You know, he can say more about nutrition, right, in 2 minutes than I would ever be able to say in an hour. I mean, he is super, super knowledgeable, and it's very, very fun. And this is really valuable information near and dear to our heart at SEAL Fit to help you not just train harder and better physically, but to fuel yourself properly. Okay. And fueling your body has a major impact. You know, we like to say that it's got about 50% of the game. So if physical training is 50% and mental training is 50%, well, nutrition is the other 50%. So there you go. You got 100%, 150% to work with. Let's go to the interview with Rob. Have fun. And before we start, oh yeah, just a reminder, if you're not on our email list, then drop your email into the opt-in form at sealfit.com. This is how you're going to stay up to date on the latest podcast, latest blog, the latest SEAL Fit TV episode, which we roll out every week, as well as the weekly workout and any challenges and all sorts of cool stuff, including special discounts and offers that are only available to those on our email list. All right, so do it. And here we go with Rob Wolf. Hoo-yah.
Rob and I have known each other kind of casually for a couple of years now. I don't think we've actually met in person, have we, Rob?
I don't think so yet. We kind of run in the same circles, but I don't think we've ended up in the same room yet. Yeah.
I know. I think so. I keep looking for you at these events and stuff, and I'm sure that we'll, you know, if we don't organize a meetup, then we'll certainly bump into each other, you know, sometime soon. I'm looking forward to that. But, you know, I'm a big fan of your writing, and, you know, I've learned a lot, and I draw a lot from your work, and so I thought, you know, it'd be a great honor to have you on the show. Now, let me give you a little background. The Unbeatable Mind program came out of my work with the SEAL Fit Academies, and I've been, you know, teaching these immersion academies. You might be aware of those programs. I've been running them for about 4 years now, kind of in concert with our Kokoro camp. And so I bring folks in for a week and up to 3 weeks, the 3 weeks being our flagship program. And during these academies, I have about 15 people who live on site with me. They train from 5 in the morning until, you know, 8 or so at night, sometimes later. And then, of course, the graduation ceremony for these guys is the 50-hour Kokoro camp. The results are, you know, just almost astonishing to see what happens to these people over this 3-week period. And, you know, we really get into a lot of discussions about food, and we feed them, right? And so we try to stick to the paleo diet, but then, of course, you know, it sometimes just flies out the window when we're, you know, training late and into the night, or we're at a location where we don't have, you know, access to, you know, kind of the perfect food source, if you know what I mean. And so, anyways, nutrition is something that's really important to the academy, as is all the other mental toughness and leadership and warrior spirit training. And so in an effort to reach a much, you know, kind of broader audience and try to bring some of the concepts that I teach in the academy setting, sans the hardcore physical training, I launched the Unbeatable Mind Academy in November. And so this call is part of that academy. As I mentioned to you, we hold a subject matter expert call every month and record it and archive it. First time we've used Blog Talk Radio, though. So anyways, that's, you know, welcome to the Unbeatable Mind Blog Talk Radio call. And
thanks for having me.
Isn't that cool? Yeah. So I'm really excited to have you. So what I would do is, rather than me blab, people have heard me blab enough here, what I wanted to do is just kind of, you know, have a conversation with you. And then what we'll do is we'll see if we can ferret some questions, if we can figure out how this system works. If not, now I've got a ton of questions of my own. But why don't we just start with just kind of a general background, Rob, like where you're from and kind of how you got into both fitness and your interest in nutrition.
Oh, gosh, that's a potentially quasi-long story. California State powerlifting champion back in the day, had a 565 squat, 565 dead, and a 345 bench at about 181 pounds. That was in the
good
teenage
God.
Division, and always kind of a strength and power athlete, like,
right.
You know, just kind of oriented that way. Have done some kickboxing, a little bit of jiu-jitsu and stuff like that. But, you know, I've always been interested in performance, health, longevity. At some point along the line, I kind of shifted my eating in a kind of high-carb, low-fat, kind of vegetarian sort of approach, and it made me wickedly ill and just about killed me, and kind of giving you the Reader's Digest on that. And that was really how I came across this whole paleo diet concept, was trying to figure out how I was going to eat so that I didn't have ulcerative colitis and high blood pressure and all the stuff that a high-carb, you know, grain-based diet had done to me. That was almost 15 years ago, and that led me into doing research fellowship with Professor Lauren Cordain, who's the author of The Paleo Diet and kind of the guy that really cracked this thing open on a larger scale. And we eventually, with my wife, opened a gym in Northern California. We were one of the first CrossFit affiliates. We were CrossFit NorCal originally. Now we're NorCal Strength and Conditioning. We were the fourth affiliate. I helped co-found the first and fourth affiliates in history, I guess, and worked with those guys for a while doing nutrition stuff, and then eventually kind of did my own thing, wrote a New York Times bestselling book on this topic, have a podcast that's ranked between like number one and number four on iTunes and the kind of health and fitness genre. Usually the folks that are I'm duking it out with are like Jillian Michaels or you know, somebody that's got like an international TV show or something like that. And so, you know, I kind of draw that stuff as being kind of an indication that what we're doing is, it's definitely popular, but, you know, I'm kind of like, okay, well, why is it popular? And the thing that I draw from that is just that it's probably working, you know, otherwise folks would
exactly, yeah, it works. That's why it's popular.
Yeah, you know, they wouldn't talk about it. They wouldn't share notes with folks. We've had a big reach out from, like, the Naval Special Warfare and the operator community, you know, you know, in addition to helping folks with a host of like degenerative diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, multiple sclerosis, stuff like that. You know, so I mean, we seem to be bracketing like the elite level athletic scene as well as the folks who are really, really sick, and using a prescription that really isn't that much different. You know, one is higher calorie than the other, one may be higher carb than the other, but really at the end of the day, it doesn't look all that much different.
Right. Understand that. Back to Leon Cordain, you know, he is the father of the paleo diet. Did you just stumble into that just because he was teaching at the school? Or did you kind of seek him out, or how did that come about? That's pretty interesting.
Well, you know, when I was sick, I was just stumped about what the heck I was supposed to do because, you know, again, I was eating this high-carb, low-fat, vegetarian diet. My doctors thought that the diet was the only thing keeping me alive while I had a 140 over 90 blood pressure. I had ulcerative colitis so bad they wanted to do surgery on me. And so I just didn't know what to do. And then we discovered that my mom had a couple of different autoimmune diseases, lupus and rheumatoid arthritis being kind of the biggies. And her doctors figured out that she had an intolerance to grains and she had an intolerance to dairy being kind of the really big ones there.
Right.
And when I thought about that, I was kind of like, and she also had some problems with legumes. So it was like grains, legumes, and dairy. And so when I was thinking about this thing, I was like, well, what the heck do you eat if you don't eat grains, legumes, and dairy? And when did those things hit the dietary scene for humans? And I had this whole, you know, kind of, you know, train of thought. And what popped into my head was paleo diet. You know, I had heard this concept batted around, this idea of eating the way that our evolutionary ancestors ate, and that might somehow be beneficial based on, you know, genetic adaptation for a particular environment and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally just like put paleo diet in a search engine, found Lauren and started reading all of his work. And this is back in 1998. So there wasn't much out there, but even what was out there clearly indicated that, you know, this shift from a hunter-gatherer way of life to an agriculturalist way of life seemed to have some pretty significant problems with regards to health, particularly with some gastrointestinal kind of health.
Right.
And so that's
Sorry about that. You know, I feel like I could allude to your book. I love, you know, how you kind of trace, you know, looking at skeletal records of kind of our caveman ancestors, and they've got really perfect teeth and, you know, well-formed bone structures and all that. And then, you know, you compare that to the modern human, right, who's just a complete wreck when they put them in the ground, and how that really came about right when the agrarian revolution came. We started eating basically, you know, wheat and those mass-produced foods, and how, you know, our diet's gone to shit since then.
Yeah, I mean, typically we're eating less protein, we're eating, you know, not as much vitamins, minerals, and stuff like that, and we're including the grains. And folks will kind of, you know, they'll raise an eyebrow about this stuff. They're kind of like, I don't know, this seems kind of wacky. But one of the best indicators that I've got is how many folks have had their wisdom teeth pulled.
Right.
And just about everybody I can think of, you know, typically they have their wisdom teeth pulled. They get them pulled because there's dental crowding, you know, you don't have enough room in your jaw to house these things, and they come in impacted and whatnot. And does it, you know, why the heck is it like that? And it's because the, you know, we're eating comparatively a nutrient poor diet. We don't get the normal formation of our dental arches. And so we have problems with these final adult molars coming in. And, you know, think about what dentistry would have been like in the Paleolithic. You know, it's non-existent. And
right.
That's kind of a game changer or a game ender, depending on how you look at it. If it's the norm for your teeth to come in and not have enough room, and then you become septic and die from it, that's kind of a problem. So that's
right.
One of the really, you know, like people can kind of wrap their head around, like, oh, yeah, maybe if things were different, if I ate differently, if my mom ate differently, and that affected the way that I'm developing and growing, then I should actually have enough room to fit all of those molars in.
Right. You know, I'm just assuming that everyone on our call here is familiar with the basics of the paleo solution, you know, kind of what this prescription is. But why don't we just, you know, before we get too far and make too many assumptions, just kind of recap at a very high level, you know, what it is. What does it mean to eat like a caveman, and what to avoid, you know, from
sure,
the modern diet?
Sure. You know, for me, the exclusion deal is the easiest. You know,
right.
We would put a, you know, kind of a no grains, no legumes, no dairy, and then from there it seems kind of obvious what you would eat, but that never turns
right.
out that way. So, I mean, you know, what we're really focusing on is good protein sources, you know, chicken, fish, meat, pork, you know, I joke and I say it needs to have a face and a soul, and you need to kill it and bring its essence into your being, and so people can
right.
usually identify with that. And then we're getting carbs
right.
more from like fruits, vegetables, sweet potatoes, white potatoes, and stuff like that if you're real active and lean,
right.
instead of bread, rice, pasta, kind of stuff. Like, we're steering clear of grains in general, but again, I don't tackle, nor do I recommend folks tackle this thing as a religious doctrine. So what we're doing
right.
is creating a template for people to tinker with in the hopes that this is going to provide better performance, health, and longevity. And I think we have some really strong markers that we can use to assess this to see whether or not that's true or false. But, you know, we start with good protein, lots of fruits and veggies, good fats from like coconut, olive oil, those sorts of things. Just generally kind of minimizing like the grain, legume, dairy kind of scene. But there again, you know, like if somebody's deployed, if somebody's in a real austere environment, then we need to be a little bit more, you know, flexible with the way that we're eating. But those are the basics. And, you know, again, similar to, you know, if you have a situation where you have a top of the line gym, whether it's in, you know, in your garage or a facility that you train in, then train with top of the line material. If you are in a situation where you can eat as good as you possibly can, then eat as well as you possibly can. When you get in a more austere environment, then you may have to modify things. Like, instead of having some nice barbells and bumps and kettlebells to use in your training, then it might be sandbags and burpees and stuff like that. And
right.
similarly,
right.
to the degree you can have good quality food, eat it. And then when you start getting in a more austere environment, then you're going to have to modify things. But
exactly.
So that's kind of the, you know, what to eat, maybe how to prioritize it when you've got control over things. Eat better. When you don't have control over things, don't freak out.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I call that the 80-20 rule for our guys. And, you know, we prescribe the paleo diet, and I wanted to kind of touch on the zone as well, because I know that, you know, paleo and zone are different, and zone doesn't really speak to the quality of food you put in your body. But do you agree with the portioning, you know, 40-30-30 approach to the zone diet? Does that have any place in your world?
No, I mean, and, you know, for a variety of reasons. One is that I don't like to create food neuroses. And so the process of getting in and weighing and measuring your food, just if you want to see somebody get nuts over their food, that's a good way to do it. Now, if I've got a weight class athlete or something like that, like we have a girl, Ursula Grobler, who's on the Olympic team for the 2,000-meter rowing event, and she walks around at 64 kilos, needs to weigh in at 61 kilos, we keep a close eye on her food, but even with her, it's rare that we're going to get in a weighing and measuring scenario because she's had, you know, some problems with the food in the past, you know, kind of the psychological stuff. So it's rare that I'm going to get in and tinker with that. And I find that if you just tell people, eat a good hunk of protein, lots of fruits and veggies, get some good fat. If you are recovering well from workouts, then good to go. If you're kind of lethargic and kind of lead-legged, and eat more carbs, particularly post-workout. If you're getting a little chubby through the midsection, then dial your food back a little bit. And so I find that to be super, super easy. And even, say, like if you're working with a trainer or a coach or something like that, a quick photograph of a meal on an iPhone, you know, shipped to your coach or whatever, or you just archiving it, I find that to be so much more effective of managing people's chow versus like a food, you know, like a real detailed food log. And when you really get in and read like the zone prescriptions and stuff like that, I find it to be really lacking in protein. If you're training at a really high level, it's probably going to be lacking in carbs. And then, you know, just overall caloric content, I find it to be lacking. So it, you know, it's kind of dialed in to be a barely adequate protein level, calorie-restricted intervention for people who are overweight and, like, type 2 diabetic. And in that case, I don't see it being terrible. But even then, the lack of focus on food quality. And I think, you know, let's say somebody's type 2 diabetic, it's too many carbs for the type 2 diabetic. Like, if we carb-restrict them, they're going to do better on lower levels. And this is one of the things that I saw a lot. Like, it was interesting. It was guys frequently in the military who were eating zone proportions, but they still had high blood pressure. We cut their carb ratio in half, and then their blood pressure normalized. And so these guys were carbohydrate sensitive enough that even on zone ratios, they were having blood pressure problems because of insulin spiking and sodium retention and stuff like that. You know, if folks want to play with the zone, by all means, get in and give it a shot. But I feel like I've kind of tried that sweater on, and it did I find it rare who I can find a good prescription for that. Yeah.
Is there anything to the theory that, and this kind of ties into the zone, that you get optimal nutritional uptake when you pair proteins, carbohydrates, and fats in a meal, as opposed to saying, you know, I'm gonna munch on this piece of steak as a snack, and then later on I'm gonna have some fruits and veggies and whatnot. But if you put them all together in a meal, you get better nutritional uptake.
I would say an emphatic no, that the mixed meal is probably the least smart way to eat overall.
Interesting.
And we could look at that a couple of ways. One is actually insulin load. Like Barry Sears puts a statement out there that, you know, like fat will blunt insulin response. And in fact, it does not. It enhances insulin response. It slows the rate of entry of glucose into the bloodstream, but there's massive literature indicating that you actually get a bigger insulin spike out of a mixed meal than you do, say, like a protein fat meal, for example. And so there's argument on that case. And then on the other side of this thing, if we're dealing with a legitimately athletic population, one of the critical factors that we're thinking about is recovery. And so when we are considering recovery, either pre or post-workout nutrition, you want scenarios in which you've got protein and carbs at the exclusion of fat. And then you have other times, let's say like a before bed snack, where you want to maintain some slow release protein entering your system to stay in an anabolic in a recovery day state, but you don't necessarily want a big insulin release so that it's going to mess with blood sugar levels and stuff like that. So you would, you know, before bed, you might do a protein fat meal, military workout period, then we're really thinking protein and carbs. And right. you know, in that scenario, the rate of gastric emptying, if you slow that with a big whack of fat, it's actually slowing your recovery from exercise. And this is kind of like exercise physiology 101 stuff. I mean, it's real basic sports nutrition, sports recovery type things, and it pretty thoroughly chops the zone apart in that regard. Like our perfectly balanced, you know, macronutrient meal really doesn't have any place, particularly if we're looking at optimizing performance. You know, what we're looking at then is more carb cycling based on activity level and intensity and repleting right. glycogen stores in an intelligent manner. And,
right.
and having a whack of fat in a post-workout meal just doesn't make any sense at all, unless you're a power lifter and we've got you on a cyclic ketogenic diet. Now, that's kind of a different
right.
story, but I doubt if most of your folks are competitive power lifters. You know, they're probably over listening to Mark Bell,
right.
who does kind of
exactly.
a cyclic ketogenic diet with paleo, you know.
Right, right. Now, you know, one of that kind of brings me to a good question. You know, with the typical special ops training regimen, you know, we tend to, you know, what most people and what all CrossFitters think we do is overtrain. You know, and I built the SEALFIT workouts around the way that I trained when I was on active duty. You know, just all three workouts a day and just, you know, hitting it hard, and recovery was certainly, you know, critical to, you know, that process. And so we, you know, we slept as best we could, unless we're, you know, on a mission. Of course, on a mission, we weren't training actively, right? We were getting a lot of load placed on us, but it wasn't training. It was actually operating. So anyways, you know, how do you kind of skew the paleo diet towards someone who's doing the kind of load that we're doing in our training regimen?
You know, I mean, it really just keeping an eye on performance and body fat level, sleep, and
right.
kind of eating appropriate to that. I mean,
yeah.
typically, and this is another piece of this, if you're eating good food, you usually have some pretty good appetite regulation.
Right,
so
exactly.
You'll kind of eat at the level that you need for the activity that you're doing. Now, if you're out on a mission, then you may need to prophylactically eat because you're at such a high work output that you're going to, energy out is going to so supersede a normal appetite levels that you may have to preemptively eat. So, you know, and
right.
we would think about this almost like doing like an Ironman kind of triathlon kind of get, you need to preemptively eat. So, but other than that, I, you know, typically it's kind of just rinse, lather, repeat. You know, it's
right.
Leading with protein, partitioning carbohydrates more in that peri-workout period to kind of take advantage of the anabolic characteristics of insulin, kind of taking advantage of the anti-inflammatory characteristics of like protein fat meals when we're away from that training window. If we're actively moving, but we need to do that for like 6, 8, 12 hours, then we're consuming a little bit of protein, a good amount of fat, good amount of carbs to
mm-hmm.
just kind of keep us moving, you know, and then it's,
right.
it's right out of the playbook that we would see with like, these 100-mile foot races and stuff like that,
right.
where you keep enough dietary protein in the mix so that people don't have a serotonin overload kind of effect. Like a real heavy-duty endurance activity that lasts for hours will deplete
right.
blood glucose, then it will deplete branched-chain amino acids, and then what's left in the blood is tryptophan, and tryptophan is that precursor for serotonin and melatonin, and there have been, you know, cases where these long-durance endurance athletes, they're just eating carbs or they're just eating some carb fat and not really any protein, and they'll actually, like, be running along and then fall asleep, or they'll get very, very lethargic and tired.
Right.
So, you know,
yeah.
we need to think about things a little bit more precisely if we have a really long hump ahead of us, but,
right.
you know, most folks are not going to experience that. But
right.
you know, that those are some kind of, like, very on the fringe considerations that, you know, folks can kick around a little bit.
Right. Now, what, you know, the MRE packet, have you ever taken a look at or had one of those suckers, meal ready to eat?
Most of them are kind of gluten bombs, and I'm the celiac
right.
kid, so like those things would kill me in like one sitting. we were sitting down and this was maybe 2 years ago. We were going to try to do like a compendium of what was in the different MREs. what could you do to try to, like, you know, trade out with other dudes to make the profile
right.
a little better? You know, it's like, okay, I'll give you my brownie if you give me your peanut butter packet,
right.
and, you know,
right.
stuff like that. And usually folks do pretty well with that. And then, you know, simple things you can do is, like, bring some jerky, bring some nuts,
right.
nut butters and stuff like that, to the degree that you can bring that stuff around. And then if you do that, then you can just kind of supplement those things a little bit. And you know, it, on the pre-deployment schedule, that's when, say, like, you know, you've been eating really, really clean, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, you don't have any gluten. In that pre-deployment schedule, maybe about 6 weeks before deployment, that's when you should start dropping in, like, a piece of toast, a cookie, a beer here and there, because a lot of people will get some GI upset that can go from, like, moderate to pretty severe when they first reintroduce gluten in particular, you know, like wheat.
Right.
So that's one thing that in this community, you know, it's kind of one thing if the branch of the military or the job that you have in the military, like, you have a quick sprint to the latrine and you're okay. But, like, if you're dug into a hillside, you're going to be sitting there for, like, 3 days and you eat an MRE and then you've got the trots, like, that's going to be a serious problem. So that's a one refinement to the program that folks need to think about. Like, are you in a immediate pre-deployment phase and you've been eating really, really clean? It's actually time to dirty things up a little bit and live more like Al Bundy from Married with Children and, you know, be ready for the for the dirty food ahead of you.
That's hilarious. Yeah, we feed MREs to the folks at the Kokoro camp. So sorry guys, if you're coming to Kokoro, then you're just going to have to survive on what we give you. You know, one thing, let's talk about grains, legume, and dairy. Is there let's say you're just getting into, you know, this kind of conscious eating, we'll call it. I assume the first thing we want to cut out if we're not aware at all about what we're putting into our gullet is sugar, right? You know, just plain old sweets. Is that right? And then cut out something like the grains, and then or do you just want to...
You know, if we really look at that, I guess sugar, in that probably the most common form of way that people get sugar is usually sodas. You know, they're drinking some sort of like a sugary carbonated beverage or juice or something like that. I got to say, like, that stuff is just death. You know, it is just death. Like drinking, you know, high fructose corn syrup laden drinks. Is it, like, if you value your health, your body composition, like a... When I do stuff for Naval Special Warfare, a big focus of what I'm talking about is not just improving performance for guys when they're in the teams or something like that, but when they're out, like when you look at the health span and the lifespan of, say, professional athletes, NFL football players have an average lifespan of about 55. People who've been in special operations community, it's not much better than that. And, But all of these people, whether we're talking professional athletes or guys that have gone through some sort of selection process like the SEALs, they're genetically tougher. They're mentally tougher. They got better genetics. They can withstand higher workload and not break down. And this stuff will eventually kill you. The data is clear. So no matter how much
it's better to burn out than to fade away, right?
Yeah, and if that's the way you want to play it, that's cool. But, you know, when that burnout happens is when you are actually collecting your pension and you're doing your second career and you've still got a wife that's hot enough that you want to spend some time with her and you got some kids and grandkids kind of on the horizon. And then that's when these dudes are dying. So, you know, be really clear. You know, I'm not going to proselytize about how to live one's life, but if, you know, hanging out a while and collecting your pension and being able to have a second career and, you know, like run around with the kids and grandkids, if that's something you value, then you really need to think about the longevity element of this thing. And it's clear that a pro-inflammatory diet is a big problem. Like I don't know if you've had this guy on. If you have, he's phenomenal, but Colonel Grossman, the guy out of the Naval Academy, he wrote, you know, On Killing and Killology and all that stuff. And
it's
clear that, like, you know, inflammation, sleep disturbances, all this stuff is a huge factor for guys. And it's a lot of it's related back to, like, head trauma, and just firing like a 50 caliber weapon is giving you the equivalent of, like, a good stiff jab to the melon every time you do it, you know? And so there's a bunch of elements of the job that are inescapable. You know, you're going to experience some sort of trauma, you know, like on impact, like if you're skydiving or something like that, you're going to experience trauma when you're shooting certain, you know, large caliber weapons. You can't get away from that, but what you can fix is what quality of food goes down your pie hole, whether or not you prioritize some sleep, whether or not you prioritize taking a little bit of fish oil and some vitamin D so that your immune system isn't overactive and you're not getting, you know, worse inflammation like in your brain and your heart and lungs than what you need to experience. And those are the things that are going to determine both your performance now, but also your longevity later. And I mean, the data on that stuff is clear. It's crystal clear.
Right. Now, I always had a question about grain because my, you know, the conventional wisdom about grain was that, you know, when you process grain, then essentially it's going to enter your bloodstream, you know, faster than glucose and spike your insulin and all that. But in your book, you really talked about the grain as in, you know, having, I think you use the term antigen, or, you know, basically doesn't want to be eaten, so it fights back. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, our understanding of this stuff has kind of gotten more sophisticated with time. So for a long, long time, if you thought about nutrition at all, it was just kind of down to only the hormones, you know, hormonal release,
right.
Like carbohydrates release insulin, protein releases
right.
a little insulin, a little glucagon and stuff like that.
Right.
And where we've grown over time, we recognize that these foods also have either, you know, kind of pro or anti-inflammatory effects on the body. And inflammation is a natural process that's mediated by our immune system. If we get a cold or the flu or a virus or something like that, then our immune system ramps up and we have markers of increased inflammation, and that's good, that's appropriate because we've got an infection that we're fighting. But then if we are having inflammatory responses from our food, which I would argue that, you know, grains, legumes, and dairy are these really problematic foods in that regard, and then also like high fructose corn syrup and a couple other goodies. If we're constantly consuming these pro-inflammatory foods, then we've got, you know, some serious problems there. And so the fix with that is avoiding the inflammatory foods, but also getting insulin levels down. So, I mean, it's just kind of it's another layer of refinement. It's kind of a window within the main window that we're kind of understanding that constituents in that food may have some effects on the gut. It may have some effects on the immune system. And all of that does feed back into insulin and glucagon and stuff like that.
Right. So let's go back to grain, legumes, and dairy. Is there a ranking of which one's more inflammatory and less inflammatory? Like someone just loves their dairy and they, you know, give up grains and legumes. Are they, you know, are they going to be mostly good? I mean, how do you really counsel someone who says, I'm not going to give up my, you know, my milkshake after, you know, my workout? That's my primary source of supplementation.
Right. You know, the big one is for me is wheat. So, you know, that's just the biggie. And so, like, it, in all honesty, if we just had people shift more towards, like, rice and corn instead of wheat, I think you would see remarkable improvements in health. I mean, like, shocking improvements in health. So that's a real easy way to just kind of be like, okay, I'm going to go gluten-free, but I'll eat lots of rice and corn. And you would – I think that depending on the population, generally these folks that are in a more fit, active, healthy – kind of operator, you know, a typical kind of population, they're probably going to motor along fine on with the grains and you know, from like corn and rice. I'll argue that they'll still do better without that. And, like we've got some pretty nice testimonials on that stuff. But if they just want to do like, what's my minimum investment, maximum return, avoid wheat.
Right.
And you're pretty good to go.
So if we ditch the sandwich bread, ditch the wheat-based pasta, which is pretty much the two main source, and cereals, right? Those are the three kind of victims, or not victims, but
sources. And so, like, you know, if you're going to go out to eat, instead of getting a sandwich, do some Mexican food and do corn tortillas.
Right.
And that's a real easy alternative, you know, a way that you could navigate things with that. Now, where this changes is if I'm dealing with a sick, inflamed, autoimmune kind of population, that's where they get like this super stringent, no grains, no legumes, no dairy. And the reason why we do that is we're reversing these autoimmune conditions, like life-threatening things like lupus and multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis and stuff like that, for a healthier, population, then we may not need to be as stringent or not as stringent all the time. And definitely the weed is kind of the baddie, you know, it's the thing to focus on. Right. And let's say you go out to, you know, you go out to sushi and you want to have, you know, or like Thai food, it's like, if you sniff around on the menu and it's like, okay, this dish has wheat noodles, this dish has rice noodles, have rice noodles.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
Real basic, you know, what little operational decisions like that could really, really improve your
right.
performance and how you feel and that level of inflammation in the body.
Right. Yeah, I love my hamburger salad. Just order it without the bun and throw it on your salad.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, at the end of the day, it's pretty darn easy. I mean, it's rare that I can find myself in a situation where I just literally can't find anything to eat. I mean, I can usually spackle something together out of a 7-Eleven. I go grab some hot dogs, throw them in a tray, throw a bunch of sauerkraut on top of it, and then almost inevitably they've got, like, some nuts and then, like, an apple or a banana floating around the front counter that I can grab.
Right.
And so... Exactly.
You should do a blog post on the 7-Eleven diet.
I've done it. You know, where I'll go in, and it's just because people will bellyache and they're just kind of pussies about the whole thing. And it again, like, I don't really care what people do. Like, they can do whatever they want, but if they really, you know, if they want to legitimately give this stuff a shot, and you know, I equate it to like trying on a pair of jeans, and you know, like, do you like your ass in the jeans, and you know, like. Try this thing on and see if it works for you. And what I'm finding is generally people are like, yeah, I kind of like it. You know, I like the results. I have better body comp. I carry a little more muscle. I'm a little bit leaner. My recovery's better. My sleep's better. But then when you get in those difficult situations, like, how do you tackle this together? And again, like, almost inevitably, you can find some way to modify what you have going on. You go into a Quiznos and you're like, hey man, give me two. I'm going to order two sandwiches. Just take the meat and throw it in a bowl, put all the veggies that would be on the sandwiches, and throw some salad dressing on top, and you're done.
Right.
And that's not that hard. And if you're completely addicted to bread, then I don't know what to tell you.
You're right.
That's a different story.
That brings up a really good point. What I noticed and what a lot of people told me is that if you've got kind of the average Western diet and then you go straight to paleo, you know, like 3-2-1 go, that you will experience withdrawal symptoms from the wheat and the grain and pasta and stuff like that. You will crave it. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, it might be fairly miserable for a while.
Yeah.
In the book, we had an example, and like, this is a no-joke, real story. The woman was living on the streets and addicted to crack at one time. And I mean, just through some kind of miracle, like, she got herself together, started putting herself in school. But when she got off the crack, she started smoking and just, like, eating tons of like, sugar and you know, fake good type things. And then she started working out at a CrossFit gym, and they did a little consulting with me about, like, hey, how can we tackle this? And so we just basically started easing her into this thing. But when she was going off of sugar and wheat, she wrote me a testimonial, and it was basically like, this is so much harder than getting off of crack was. And like, this was from a crack addict who is now like an addiction and recovery counselor. And
right.
So it sounds ridiculous, but it's a no joke deal. I mean, and you don't, people don't lay in bed at night thinking about like pork loin and grapes and watermelon and stuff. They're thinking about Little Debbie snack cakes and the bag of cookies and the, you know, the carton of ice cream. And there's some, you know, this gets super nerdy, geeky stuff, but, you know, when we look at, like, the neuroregulation of appetite, the way that the brain actually knows whether we are hungry or not, those foods all have proteins in them that hit the opiate receptors, and
right.
It's the same receptors, opiate and the dopamine receptors, same things that cocaine and heroin and alcohol, those are the same dials in our head that get spun from those addictive substances. So it's not at all surprising that people get pretty spun out on that. I mean, they're legitimately like addicted substances for sure.
That's incredible. So you're saying that that when I eat a candy bar, that I'm having the same but muted response as if I took a hit of crack cocaine?
Yeah, and you know, like a candy bar, let's say it's a Snickers, I would say that one would actually be less than like eating a bagel with, you know, like a bagel sandwich kind of gig. Like the wheat, again, is really the baddie in this thing, you know,
right.
So
it's,
and so that, you know, and in that ordering, you know, people usually find that, you know, they'll like dairy, they might, and dairy can be a little bit cracky, but, you know, you stick dairy plus wheat, dairy plus sugar, wheat plus sugar.
Right.
When you start adding these things together, they've got a pretty potent response. And then, you know, think about this. Corn doesn't really have the same type of addictive type proteins in it. And you don't really see a lot of, you know, you don't have like a you know, corn, you know, some sort of a tortilla type thing with sugar and like caramel on it. I mean, you
right.
know, you make churros out of wheat. You don't make churros out of corn. And so even to some degree, when you look around at like what our desserts typically made out of, you know,
right.
it's more the cracky type stuff. So
Right. That's fascinating. So when we tell our athletes, you know, because I'm completely on board with your assessment that, you know, the zone diet and any, you know, irrational focus on diet is going to lead to some dietary problems, right, or just, you know, just being a little bit crazy, unbalanced. And so we recommend, you know, kind of you have an 80-20 approach. You know, do paleo, you know, 80% of the time roughly, and then, you know, those times where it's just inconvenient, then just don't worry about it, right? As long as
you
shifted your metabolic engine and you're basically running on all cylinders most of the time, then your body will reward you. You know, again, unless you're going for the CrossFit Games, which most of our athletes aren't, you know, you're good to go with that prescription.
Yeah, totally. And like, you know, it's something that I always try to emphasize to people, particularly folks in this operations community, special operations community, this should really simplify and improve your life. Like at the end
right.
of the day, this should make your life easier. Now there may be some learning and a little bit of adjustment and stuff like that, but if you sleep better and you have better recovery and you generally don't have blood sugar crashes and stuff like that, then your life should be significantly better. But
right.
you know, if you try this thing out, you're like, dude, this is, you know, you've given it over a month. We need a month's adaptation period here, especially if you've been, you know, living like a cockroach for a while or something like that, and just kind of banking, you know, leveraging your genetics to be able to eat and drink and do whatever you want to do. Then those folks are going to have a rough time coming through this. But give it a month, see how it goes. And if you're legitimately like, dude, this is just miserable, I think I feel a little better, but I don't really know, then, you know, go back to doing what you were doing. But what I typically find is folks are like, yeah, this is easy now that I've got it figured out, and the return on investment is so powerful that I can't really make a solid argument for eating a different way, you know, in general. But if I, you know, if I'm, you know, I'm out at a, you know, a family event or something, and there's some, you know, some cake or some pie passing around, and you do it, and then that way grandma doesn't, you know, chastise you for avoiding her dessert or something like that. You know, I mean, it's you just kind of figure out when to fight your battles and all that sort of thing.
Right. Couple more questions that I have, and then, you know, what I'd like to do is just open it up. I'll have Dustin open it up for a couple questions, and then we'll call it a day. But what about two things that, you know, are always in my mind is how much fish oil should I be taking, and is it okay to drink alcohol, and, you know, how much is kind of okay? I mean, I know just, you know, from a general health standpoint, we want to limit our alcohol intake, but is there a healthier drink to drink if you're going to have a drink a couple times a week or on the weekends?
Sure.
Let's hit the fish oil first.
You know, the fish oil thing, I think if you're in a non-deployment status, then I think people can run around like 5 to 6 grams a day. Seems to be a pretty good spot. And you just kind of have to look on what fish oil, you know, package you have, whether it's liquid or capsules, and figure out about 5 to 6 grams of EPA and DHA. In a pre-deployment and a deployment scenario where there's the potential for some injury and you know, knowing that fish oil is a blood thinner, I wouldn't go more than about 2 to 3 grams a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the amount that you would get out of like a tin of sardines. And so, I mean, you could easily meet that level from dietary means. But if you want to do a little bit of supplemental stuff to keep inflammation down while you're in a deployment scenario, like at about 2 grams, 2 to 3 grams seems completely safe. And then, you know, on the booze thing, like that's just a tough one. Like I try to steer people more towards like, you know, the NorCal margarita, like doing tequila, lemon juice, and a splash of soda water. Just basically doing like clear booze with, you know, maybe a little bit of lemon or lime juice, maybe a splash of like, you know, some other sort of fruit juice or just a little dose of sweetness. But instead of doing beer, instead of doing like kind of sugary drinks and stuff like that, I absolutely love beer, but you know, you've got the gluten issue, you've got the caloric content issue. It's a tough sell. And then, you know, there is a reality, like here's an interesting thing. People will use a drinking binge as a means for going in and getting a testosterone replacement. And the way that they will do this is they'll drink a ton. They will stay up late, and then you go to the doctor, you know, you do that two days in a row, something like that. You go to the doctor and you've got the testosterone level of a 12-year-old girl. And so, you know, it will absolutely emasculate you on your testosterone production. So, I mean, that's kind of one thing, but okay, so you're trying to game the system and, you know, maybe get on some testosterone replacement. Okay, whatever, that's cool. But if you're consistently drinking hard, and hard being more than maybe about two drinks a night or something like that, you're going to have some performance and recovery problems. And again, like we're talking about a group of people that are genetically like tougher and more resilient and all the rest of that stuff. But dude, it they aren't Wolverine. Like they are going to reach an impact point. And a lot of that, like Dave Warner, who's I think he was a Team 3 guy for about 12 years, and then he runs CrossFit Seattle. He just had a really good observation, which was the dudes that could drink all night and then get up and kick everybody's ass at PT, like that worked for about 3 to 5 years, and then they started really losing ground the 5 years to 10-year mark, and then from beyond that, if they didn't have kind of a come to Jesus moment and really change their lifestyle, like the wheels fell off the wagon on those dudes. So,
I think I'm a case in point in that. I mean, I used to run with the guys quite hard in the early days when I was at SEAL Team 3, and it worked, like you said, for about 4 years or 5 years, and then, you know, the performance just started to, you know, be impaired, and I was eating, you know, Domino's pizza and drinking beer 4 or 5 times a week with my teammates, and that didn't last long, obviously, after that.
Yeah. At some point, you start getting some diminishing returns out of that scene, for sure.
Exactly. That prescription is not recommended these days.
No.
That's great stuff. You know, one thing that that Tim Ferriss recommends in his book, and he's got a lot of very interesting and probably somewhat controversial ideas, but this one made a lot of sense, is if you're going to drink, you know, drink at least a couple hours before bed to get, you know, let the sugar kind of flush through your system so you don't have sleep impairment from the alcohol.
Yeah, you know, booze, it blocks the ability to go into too deep restorative sleep, and there's a really sharp doc who's down in Coronado, Kirk Parsley, who's been doing a lot of stuff with the teams down there, and you know, all of these over-the-counter sleep medications, the prescription stuff, Lunesta, alcohol, you know, what these things do is they induce a state of unconsciousness, but it's not sleep. You know, sleep is a completely distinct metabolic process and physiological process. And alcohol blocks a significant part of that. And it blocks the really deep level 3-4 sleep. And you don't really recover. You don't release growth hormone. You don't produce testosterone. Your connective tissue doesn't recover. And so if you're gonna do some drinking, I mean, the funny thing is it's like, well, what do I do? Well, you drink earlier and then leave a window of time later, you know, so that you've got a wider margin of error before you go to bed. And people will say, well, how much earlier do I drink? And it's basically like as early as you can. Like you want as much time between the alcohol consumption and going, you know, before you go to bed as you possibly can. I still haven't found a culture where they start drinking at like 3 PM and then they turn on the disco music and you get your dance on and then you're in bed by like 8:30 or 9:00. But, that would be nice if that ever happened, but I don't think it's going to work. So
yeah, that would be kind of nice. Listen, I'd like to open it up for some questions if you got time, Rob.
Sure.
Okay. Dustin is going to go ahead and unmute the line. So if you got a burning question out there and you're listening in, then, in about 10 seconds, I think the line will be unmute, and we'll hold some questions. One kind of last question I had is, you know, what if you are one of these people who, you know, this information is, you know, revolutionary, and you're listening in, and you're saying, holy cow, you know, Rob just described, you know, me. I've got, you know, I'm overweight, and I've got heart, you know, some sort of, you know, early onset of heart disease and, you know, pre-diabetes or whatever. And, you know, obviously my doctors haven't been prescribing diet.
I think if I dial in, I'm going to Matt.
So I think we're on here. Anyways, let's finish. So if, you know, how long does it take your body to respond to the paleo if you're really sick and you know, to come back into homeostasis?
So,
oh, shoot. You know, people start feeling better
about the people that can drink for 24
hours within a couple of days. So,
right.
Yeah. But, you know, they'll start feeling worse sometimes again because they're kind of, you know, they're coming off sugar, they're coming off of wheat and whatnot. But we can see blood lipid changes in a week.
No
kidding. You know, like changes in cholesterol, changes in triglycerides and stuff like that. Yeah, very, very quickly.
Right. Okay. Is anyone obviously someone's not paying attention, and when we unmute it, they're talking in the background, so that could be a little distracting.
Okay,
but if anyone out there has a question for Rob, why don't we let's hit him up, and then we'll see what comes up. We'll just take a few questions.
I was curious if you're familiar with Mark Sisson and Primal Blueprint, and if you are, could you elaborate a little bit on how paleo and primal differ?
Oh, gosh, yeah, Mark's a good friend of mine. We probably talk at least once or twice a week. He's a great dude. I love his program. I mean, really, they're kissing cousins. I mean, I always joke that I'm the paleo guy who eats primal because, you know, Mark's really the distinction there is the primal gig is a little more lenient on the dairy piece. But even for me, I'm lenient with it after the 30-day intervention. I usually just try to hump people's knee to really eat very, very clean for 30 days, no grains, no legumes, no dairy, then reintroduce and kind of see how you do. Mark tackles it a little bit differently in that he'll give you a little bit of an 80-20 kind of gig on the ramp-up until you hit a point where you're not getting the results you want. If you've got an autoimmune disease and it's not resolving, then he will tighten things up. I tighten things up from the beginning. He'll give you a little bit of a run-up, but, I mean, it's two sides of the same coin. I think his book is outstanding. His website is phenomenal. So, I mean, I really can't say enough good stuff about Mark. He's a good dude.
I agree, and I think Mark's generally geared toward, you know, just the – probably the older set, you know, he's coming at it from his kind of his perspective in the world, whereas I think you came out of the athletic / CrossFit world, and so, you know, your writing and your appeal started from that kind of perspective as well. But they are meeting in the middle, if I'm not mistaken, both your flaws.
Yeah, and you know, I would almost put myself more in the I'm coming from the medical, sick, broken side more even than the athletic side. I mean, I definitely catered to that scene, but that's been formative in why I'm so stringent up front, because we've seen such shocking changes with people with like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or something. Yeah.
Right. Cool. Any other questions out there?
Hey, Rob, quick question. Sorry. Go ahead.
Hey, Rob, this is Kurt in San Francisco. Mark, great program,
hey,
by the way. Question for you. I had some good results with a book called Nutrient Timing, which really focuses on using a high glycemic carb and a protein directly after working out. How does the paleo feel about that? And kind of do you support that? And how would you kind of teach people to eat immediately after workout?
Yeah. I mean, early in the conversation, Mark asked me a couple of questions kind of alluding to that, you know, just really keeping an eye on post-workout nutrition. We've worked like with some very high level folks like Ursula Grobler, who's the world record holder in the 2000 meter rowing event at the Olympic Training Center, Glenn Cordozo, who's the IFC lightweight world champion, Frank Mir and Forrest Griffin have been doing this stuff, and there's a pretty cool YouTube video about Frank Mir talking about me and kind of like giving me some props on his food. And all that we do, I mean, post-workout is usually just like some sort of protein, like some chicken, fish, meat, and then like a yam or a sweet potato. I've tinkered with things, you know, like whey protein plus like waxy maize starch or, you know, something like that. And
yeah, that's what I was using.
Yeah, and you know, it's rare that I find the person who's at the volume or the intensity of training that they really need that relative to just real food, honestly. And it's just something that what I would recommend doing is comparing, you know, try to have a similar training block with regards to, like, training, you know, volume and intensity and whatnot. Do one block with the, you know, the immediate post-workout meal being the waxy maize starch and like, a whey protein or something, and then do the other one with a solid meal and just kind of see how you do. But I see enough people have GI problems from the whey or from the waxy maize starch that, you know, it's even though maybe it's getting in their system a little faster, but then we're fighting some other upstream inflammatory problems. And so I think the basic concept is bulletproof, you know, like take care of that post-workout window, but then there's a little bit of tinkering and refining to do and just see, you know, does that liquid food actually benefit you more than real food? And you know, also there's a little backside to that too. I'm just so reticent to recommend shakes and stuff like that to the general scene, because folks who are overweight and sick and inflamed, they're always looking for a cheat. And so I don't give them any out at all. So even for the athletes, I'm real reticent to recommend that stuff, just because then everybody thinks they're an athlete and then they end up fat and sick. So
thank you very much.
Yeah, totally.
Rob,
that's great.
Rob, real quick, John from Orlando, and you said it there on as far as cheat. As far as a cheat meal, you know, even outside of the 30-day window, if you're kind of doing paleo all the time, are you, you know, is it okay to go out and have that pizza, or would you rather, you know, paleo it up, or kind of what's your thought on that as far as either a motivation or just something to be able to do every now and again?
You know, like, if I'm kind of a gluten, kind of nutcase guy, and so, like, if I'm going to, like, dive in front of a bus and save somebody, it's about the gluten deal. So let's say you're going to go out and kick your heels up, and you've got an option of pizza and beer or nachos and tequila. I would do the nachos and tequila because you've got corn and cheese versus wheat and cheese, and then let's say you're going to go get some dessert. I would do more, you know, like ice cream and dark chocolate versus like a cake or cookies or something like that. So, you know, and then in that way, I don't even look at it as like cheat meals. It's just, you know, you end up in a Mexican food place and there's some really good food and the nachos look really good and I just have some nachos and I'm not really like, oh my God, this is my cheat meal. And I don't set it up like a heroin addict kind of gig where I'm planning my cheat meal like 12 days in advance because it is some epic, you know, kind of blow up. I just like it to roll in with your normal eating. If you end up someplace where there's some good food, you know, there's some like some flan or like a gluten-free tort or something, dude, kick your heels up, you know, then you have your steak, you have a glass of wine, you have some grilled veggies because you saw that there was that gluten-free tort on the menu. Like, dude, that's where I'm going to put my carbs. I'm going to have one glass of wine instead of two, and then I'm going to have that tort at the end. And like that just still seems like a totally kick-ass meal to me, you know? I mean, a steak and some veggies and a glass of wine and a really nice, like, artisanal gluten-free tort. Like, that seems pretty legit. And I just didn't even blink an eye at that. You know, that seems like a great meal, so.
Right, it does. Well, thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Totally.
I love your take on that, Rob, because it's really in alignment with mine. And I'm kind of laughing, thinking about, again, Tim Ferriss's approach. And I've got to get him on this program because I think it would be a really, really interesting call. But Tim, you know, I think he says basically his cheat day is Sunday, and he does program it, and he gorges himself to the point where he gets sick and doesn't want to eat, you know, that crap ever again. And so he's back on his diet by Monday.
Yeah,
don't recommend that approach personally.
Yeah, Tim's a friend of mine, but there's a couple of the things like that where I'm just kind of like throwing my hand over my face, like, I don't know if I would throw that one out there. But yeah, to each their own, though. I mean, tinker with it.
Exactly.
My big thing with stuff like that is it's kind of like people end up doing that one day bender of hookers and cocaine, and then they don't come back. Like,
right,
they're just
it turns
gone.
Into two, three, four, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other questions out there for Rob?
Yeah, I have a question.
This is Stephen, New Jersey. Your comment on testosterone was actually pretty timely because a very good friend of mine just told me that his testosterone was at like 250 and they wanted to put pellets under his skin. And I think your testosterone comments were based around alcohol before.
Right.
What the diet? How old is this dude? He's 55. Let's say he's 58.
How tight is his eating habits? How tight is his lifestyle? Like, is he eating better? Is he getting some good vitamin D? Like, those are some big things to check out upstream, because all those will antagonize testosterone production. You know, like, if you have a ton of stress, bad sleep, you produce a lot of cortisol. The cortisol will compete with the substrate. It'll either turn into testosterone or cortisol. And so if you're really overtrained, you know, real stressed out, bad sleep, that's where training decreases start happening. When you're overtraining is you start producing more cortisol, and there's this process called pregnenolone steal where you steal the substrates that should be getting turned into testosterone, and they go into cortisol. So, I mean, there's some stuff to look at with that. Now, all that stuff said, if the dude's 55 and he's at 280, but he's otherwise got – you know, he's eating paleo and he's trying to fix his sleep and stuff like that. I would definitely, you know, check out a good anti-aging doc and start looking at ways to prop that scene up. If there's one thing, whether you're male or female, if you can get some help dietarily, lifestyle-wise and everything to bring your hormone status back into line with what it was when you were youthful, I think there's some really good benefit to that. I think it's weird in our country. We're very puritanical about therapeutic hormone replacement, and it's kind of wacky. I mean, you're just replacing something that's naturally there anyway, but we have some, you know, we're so puritanical about the athletes, you know, drug, you know, doping and all that sort of stuff, that then it kind of spills over into like the life maintenance scene. If you have a type 2 diabetic, I would argue that a low carb diet is the intervention that you got to do, but let's say you're going to do a pharmacological intervention, you're going to give them a drug. If you have a type 2 diabetic male, the one thing that you could give them that would fix all metabolic parameters you have on, whether it's cholesterol or inflammation or whatever, is give them testosterone, all of their stuff improves. Insulin sensitivity, the cholesterol, the whole ball of wax. Now, I think there's a lot of other stuff you need to think about, like aromatization of testosterone and estrogen and stuff like that. But, yeah, I mean, I think folks should be giving a little bit of thought towards that stuff and tackling it in an intelligent way. But I would really get their food and vitamin D and lifestyle in check first. Otherwise, you're really not going to get the benefit out of the you know, the tinkering.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Thank you.
Great stuff. Let's have one more question. I know there's a lady out there.
I have a question.
This
is Debbie in Oregon.
Debbie.
And one is for Mark. Is this being recorded for archive later?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And for Rob, you mentioned about wheat in particular. What about oats? And for people
oats,
who
barley.
Are looking, go ahead.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, for people who are looking for another protein supplement, I'm coming at it from another point of view because I'm a nurse and sometimes I deal with people who have had bariatric surgery and they have a hard time getting enough protein. So I've recommended the whey protein in the past, but if that's an inflammatory protein for them, do you have a secondary recommendation or a secondary preference?
Oh, gosh. So, you know, wheat, rye, oats, barley, millet all contain either gluten or proteins that are virtually indistinguishable from gluten. They're maybe like 2 or 3 amino acids different. So, I mean, they're damn near, you know, the same thing immunologically. They're highly reactive. Most dietitians consider oats to be gluten-free, which as a chemist, I would say, yeah, it is, because gluten is 3 amino acids different than avenin, which is what's in oats, but oats still cause a wicked a GI response. So, I, you know, that's
okay.
Kind of where that stuff exists. And then, you know, it's just such a – I don't even know what to say about the bariatric scene. You know, it's like, so we – perform a pretty high-risk surgery, reducing the ability for this individual to consume food to a degree that now we have a hard time reaching a critical mass with regards to basic nutrient intake. I just don't know. I mean, the recidivism on this thing too, like usually the bariatric surgery, you've got about a 2 to 5 year window before they're kind of back heading back up the slope again. But insurance companies will pay for it because I think they're kind of hoping that the person dies somewhere in that process and cease to cost them money. So I honestly don't know what to tell you. I mean, when we give people, here's an interesting thing, when people have had a gastric bypass, whether it's banding or you know, actual surgical excision of the stomach mass, they get an enhanced insulin response to food. So even smaller amounts of food, smaller amounts of carbohydrate produce an even larger negative metabolic response to the meal. And so this thing just seems like such a goat rope to me. I don't know. I don't know.
It's bad science.
I agree with you, but dealing with a patient that is post-bariatric surgery and I'm trying to help them with a protein recommendation, right. Do you have a second preference after whey?
No, because they all do the same thing. That's the problem. Like,
okay.
Liquid food is bad. Like when you think about the rate at which this stuff enters the blood, it's really bad, both on the carbohydrate and the protein level, and that's really the big problem with these kind of insulin spiking and kind of pro-inflammatory conditions and why it will kind of end up kind of getting them down the road to you know, some other problems. So the liquid food again is problematic, but then I know, you know, these people are dealing with having like a apple sized stomach to eat with at the end of this thing. So it's that's why I only did 1 year of medical school and grabbed a parachute and jumped out the door. I didn't want to be within spitting distance of any of that stuff. I don't know what to do. Like, God love you for doing that, but it's just it's like working in the funny farm. You know, it's a tough
some
deal,
days.
Man. Yeah, yeah. So I'm I apologize that I don't have a more sound response.
Okay, thank you.
You know, it, to the degree you can educate the folks to eat paleo-esque, you know, lowish carb and nutrient dense veggies and stuff like that, but it's tough. Like it literally, they limit the amount of food that people can eat to such a degree that they then start pureeing and processing food to get it in them easier, which just seems insane to me, like just patently insane. So, and you know, there's some really good interesting deal. Like I had a reach out from some local docs here in Reno, and one of them is a plastic surgeon, and for their program, instead of doing liposuction, somebody will come in and they're like, hey, I want to do some liposuction. They're like, cool, that'll cost this, but what we're going to do first is this lifestyle intervention where they get them on my book and they do a paleo challenge, like almost identical to what we do in the gym, and then 6, 8, 12 weeks later the person has lost a ton of weight. And then they end up kind of heading into other routes with the plastic surgery instead of doing the lipo. And so, I mean, I think this, you know, what we really need to look at is just like give people a legitimate, you know, effective treatment methods, which is a kind of ancestrally based diet, and we'll start getting some headway. But obviously that's a whole other gig. I mean, the surgical wing in the hospital is the moneymaker. You know, you take away the surgery and there's not a lot of cash that's generated then, so.
Wow. Hey, listen, this has been a terrific, terrific call, Rob. I wish we could keep going, but I know you got things to do, and as do all of our listeners. So I wanted to, you know, thank you, immensely from the bottom of my heart for your time here, and I, you know, it's just been very enlightening to me. I've actually learned a ton from you in this call, and have to go adjust some of the things I'm teaching my folks here at SealFit, so I really am grateful for that. So having said that, we will follow up, Rob, and I'm looking forward to maybe personally meeting you soon. And again, thank you and good luck with all of your endeavors. And I appreciate
it. Thanks, man. I'm always a huge fan of what you're doing, so thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Wow, man, I told you that'd be cool, and was I right? Rob is just chock full of information. Check him out at robwolf.com. His book is The Paleo Solution. So awesome stuff, and I really appreciate it, Rob. Thank you very much. Listen, before we go, I want to remind you that this show is sponsored by MetLife Defender. It's ML Defender, which is a new identity theft protection program backed by MetLife, and I use it now. I kind of upgraded from LifeLock. It's more comprehensive, and it's a really important component to your overall safety and security. You know, I teach people how to defend themselves physically, but, you know, I can't really teach you how to defend yourself digitally, and this is what they do, all right? So get it before, you know, someone hacks your credit card and makes your life miserable, all right? Just want to protect the tribe, and this is an important area, you know. So I wouldn't endorse it if I didn't believe in it. Okay, folks, stay focused, train hard, and have fun. We'll see you next time. Hoo-yah. Coach Devine out.
Lock and load, boys. Time to explode, boys. Make sure you get home, boys. They got your back. The pride of the fleets. The bright swinging frogmen of the UTT.